If you ask an average person in this country, and I'm sure you've all heard it, our housing prices are directly connected to immigration. Jobs, immigration. Affordability, immigration. Pierre Poilievre just did a whole campaign last week, which Breach made a video about, thank you, about how, in fact, our healthcare lines are due to immigration. You can blame migrants for everything. Now, we know that racism is a strategy to divide the working class, that it is a way through which people are being pitted against each other to distract from holding those at the top responsible. Right? We know that. But what we're facing as a result of that is a very specific kind of mass exclusion. We have seen, you know, depending on how you count the numbers, between 1.2 and 1.8 million people whose study and work permits were not being able to renew last year. That's, you know, between 3,000 and 3,500 people daily left the country. As a result of that, we are seeing this massive cuts to our tax system, right? So it's a $50 billion reduction to the tax revenue. The GDP growth is down 3 points just in the last few years. Some of it has to do with tariffs. Some of it has to do with the fact that Canada has actually been using, not just Canada, all these countries have been using immigration since at least the 90s as a bit of a substitute to economic growth. Because if you bring in millions of people and they work and they spend money here, then you can actually get over the fact that what has happened here in the post sort of NAFTA free trade moment and the way in which our society has largely been deindustrialized, particularly in rural centers, particularly because we know what it's like to be in rural communities because we organize farm workers. And what's happened is immigration has kind of somehow managed to hold up the economy. When you've got millions of people paying into your welfare system but not being able to access it, that allows for your schools to be funded, for your healthcare to be functional, right? So for the last 30 years, migrants have been propping up this country. They've been propping up this country while being excluded, while being exploited, and now we're being scapegoated, and as we're being pushed out, you've entered a kind of this, like, doom circle, basically, because people are struggling to pay rent, they're struggling to afford their homes, they're struggling to afford groceries, they're struggling to get good jobs, and they're being told that the problem is migrants. And then migrants are being pushed out, but the economy will worsen. And those same people are going to be told, okay, the problem is still migrants. And so they're going to call for more migrants to be pushed out. And the circle continues. Unless we break this cycle, there is really no other way through. Permanent resident status is dropping. And as permanent resident status is dropping, so is funding for settlement agencies in a huge way, right? So is cuts to the federal public sector, right? Because, and what is that doing? That means that there are fewer people out there defending migrants in the communities, putting out talking points against anti-immigrant rhetoric. The overall space is shrinking. And so when us in the migrant justice movement are speaking up, our voices are frankly not being heard. We are organizing migrants in our communities every day. You know, last year, for example, we were able to win hundreds of thousands of dollars in stolen wages back from employers. During a massive heat wave, we were able to get ACs into homes where homes are 40 degrees Celsius inside, right? So we can win those kinds of changes. But what we can't do is deal with this overwhelming economic crisis that migrants are both being blamed for and their exclusion is worsening, right? This is what we were at before Carney's election, okay? This isn't, and then Carney comes in, and what does he do? One of his first major bills, Bill C-12, right? Currently Bill C-12, then Bill C-2, is effectively, does two main things. One is that, and it will pass next week. It'll pass next week. We're trying our hardest to stop it, but there's no, it's in Senate. What it does is it says that any person who's a refugee claimant who's been here for longer than 1 year will not be able to seek asylum or protection. Letters are going to go out, and people are going to suddenly find that their refugee application, even if they've made it, suddenly is going to be put into another system called the PRA application process. The other thing that they're doing is they've given themselves the power to cancel any groups of immigration permit whenever they want. What is a group? Gender is a group. Race is a group. Ethnicity is a group. Nationality is a group. Age is a group. Region is a group. Being able to cancel groups of permits like that is now going to be enshrined in law for this and all future governments. All future governments will have this power. And that's just the first major bill he's brought on immigration. 1,000 new CBSA offices are going to be hired. That's our version of ICE. Right now, deportations have almost doubled. They've gone up to about 22,000 last year. That number was closer to 7,000 during COVID. And the surveillance and the technology that is being brought in Canada is at a much higher pace. AI is now going to be used to make a lot of these decisions. It's already being used to make these decisions. So as we are seeing the economic system completely be forced to be restructured.
This is a highlight from a new episode of The Breach Show. Find new episodes at breachmedia.ca, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Sierra Club Canada's The Environment in Canada is a weekly podcast exploring climate change, biodiversity, renewable energy, and democracy with host Connor Curtis in Montreal. On this highlight from a recent episode, Connor explains why oil and gas interests are lying about the future of their projects while profiting from the war on Iran. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to another episode of the Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast about the environment in Canada by Sierra Club Canada. I'm Connor Curtis, Director of Communications at Sierra Club Canada, and today we have a very short episode that will be going into correcting a few myths about what's going on with the Iran war, oil prices, the future of oil projects, and the future of renewable energy. This is a timely discussion, and we have research and information about this that's already available. So getting a short episode out to you seemed the best use of time this week. So let's clarify a few points of misinformation that are circulating largely from oil and gas industry sources at this time. High oil and gas prices as a result of the American war with Iran do not make Canadian oil, gas, and LNG projects more likely. But oil and gas companies will profit off of the price speculation that's happening at the expense of Canadians and the resulting inflation that we experience in prices. Proposed oil pipelines, gas, and LNG projects are years away from being developed, and current shocks in prices are actually likely to reduce demand for oil and gas in the future by convincing oil and gas consuming countries to shift to cheaper and more stable renewable energy faster than they were before. Experts such as Microsoft's energy chief and energy writers like Max Fawcett have already pointed this out. The International Energy Agency still expects oil demand to plateau around 2030, contrary to what you might have heard, due to the global shift to renewable energy. And there are already enough oil and gas projects globally to meet that demand, making new proposed projects in Canada unviable. So recent oil and gas price volatility brought on by American foreign policy, as well as American actions to cut off oil supplies to Cuba, are likely to convince oil and gas consuming countries to transfer to renewable energy at an even faster rate than that, because renewables paired with battery storage and grid solutions provide localized, reliable and cheap energy that outcompetes oil and gas right now, let alone with high oil and gas prices. And because baseload power is no longer an obstacle in that regard, renewables paired with battery storage really gets around that problem. But the following three outcomes are likely, and these are things to watch for. The price of fossil fuels in Canada will rise, increasing the cost of living. But this is only partially because of supply shocks due to the situation in Iran. It's actually largely because of speculation. In other words, oil and gas corporations will make a lot of profit off Canadians via inflated prices that are only partially the result of actual supply problems. This speculation was what really happened after Russia invaded Ukraine, and it helped cost Canadians $12,000 per household. You can can find out more about that at falseprofits.ca. I'll put a link in the description. As economist Jim Stanford pointed out recently, the gasoline in the pumps right now was refined weeks ago before all of this started. Here's the second thing that will happen. Oil and gas interests will use price increases to try to pitch massive new oil and gas and LNG, that's liquefied natural gas, projects, even though those projects take years to come online. And they're really betting that you won't do the math on the years. There will be plenty of vague statements that will come from politicians, like the world needs our oil and gas. But again, new oil and gas and LNG projects like Slism's LNG or a West Coast oil pipeline still don't have a business case. Price volatility and fluctuations in the short term are not a business case for projects that need decades and decades of demand that already was not going to be there and definitely is not going to be there now. I mean, remember all the LNG projects that were going to be necessary to help Europe because of what was happening in Ukraine, the LNG projects in Canada that never happened because they never had a business case and still don't. And again, that brings us back to point number three. When oil and gas prices rise, oil and gas consuming nations and regions speed up their transition to renewable energy because renewables are the cheapest form of energy and already outcompete oil and gas. Because countries are electrifying and because battery and grid systems mean renewables no longer need that base load power to be applied locally. That makes oil and gas and LNG projects in Canada less likely, not more. A majority of Canadians connect oil and gas dependence with instability, as well they should, and believe renewable energy would strengthen Canadian sovereignty. A new opinion poll from February 2026 found that 67% of Canadians say reliance on oil and gas increases the risk of international conflict. 59% of Canadians believe Canada would be safer if we produced more renewable energy in light of U.S. aggression towards Venezuela and Greenland. 58% say transitioning away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy is more important than ever. Only 11% of Canadians say it's less important. So Canadians are also strongly opposed to foreign aggression to secure access to natural resources. 70% say it's completely unacceptable for one country to use military force to take control of another country's resources. 72% say it would be unacceptable for the United States to have arrested Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to access oil reserves. 80% say it would be unacceptable for the United States to seize Greenland for its natural resources. Additional polling that was done by Abacus Data found that 70% of the public would feel pride if Canada were to become a renewable energy superpower versus only 30% feeling that way about becoming an oil and gas superpower. And what's interesting is that these results include a majority of Albertans, 56%, who preferred renewable energy superpower over oil and gas superpower, and 79% of people living in Newfoundland and Labrador preferred renewable energy superpower over an oil and gas superpower. Donald Trump has already said that he wants to see oil prices go lower than ever before once his war on Iran ends. Now, that isn't very reliable, but I think it speaks to the price volatility that you're seeing and the likelihood that that volatility will continue. Again, no country is watching what's happened in Cuba and saying oil and gas is great to rely upon as an energy source. Countries around the world are going to be looking at this situation and saying, how do we get cheap energy that is reliable, that we can locally produce? And the answer to that is renewables, battery storage, grids. Even China is not overly concerned with what is happening in Iran because they know already and have been working to corner the renewable energy economy. That's where they see the future being. And it would behoove us in Canada to not only invest in renewable energy, but to do so in a way that prioritizes oil and gas dependent regions so that we can make sure that there is an alternative to oil and gas employment, oil and gas revenue for people there by building renewable options locally. You can go to the link in the description to find sources for everything I've said here. You can read what Microsoft's energy chief said and what writers like Max Fawcett have said. I would also encourage you to go to falseprofits.ca and see some of the economic work that's been done analyzing the impact of these volatile price increases on Canadian consumers. But most of all, go out and talk to other people about this. Help counter the spin. We do not need Canada to go down the path of investing in a bunch of useless oil, gas, and LNG projects when that money is really desperately needed to make us a renewable energy economy that's actually beneficial for people in the future. Before we end today, just a reminder that you can take action on environmental issues by visiting sierraclub.ca. We have tons of petitions, other actions and events, and regular news updates you can sign up for on the homepage. You can also find Sierra Club Canada on social media, and you can listen to the Environment in Canada podcast on the Harbinger Media Network, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast also airs on CKUT Broadcast Radio in Montreal, 90.3 FM, bi-weekly on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Don't forget to click follow or subscribe so you get the latest episodes from us.
Excerpt from a new episode of The Environment in Canada. Find it at sierraclub.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode is brought to you by the Alberta Advantage podcast. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, broadcasting since the early 80s, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. In this recent interview, the team examines the fallout from Vancouver Mayor Ken Sim's false accusations that City Councillor Sean Orr was dealing drugs. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. On the podcast today, Ian Mass with City Beat for March 7th. There's a lot to cover in today's City Beat. The fallout from accusations that city councillors are dealing drugs, plus yet more money for the World Cup, a 30-year plan for Vancouver's growth, the fate of Car Free Day festivals, and more. Here to tell us about all this is Red Eye Collective member Ian Mass with his City Beat report. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Jane.
Well, partisan politics in Vancouver took a very ugly turn over the past week with the accusations I just mentioned. Remind us where this all started.
Well, it's a fairly short history, but first I need to give credit to CBC's Justin McElroy for his work on this issue and a lot of the things I'm going to say in this report. But it started a couple of weeks ago with a motion by Councillor Bly to reverse what she calls the costly ban on supportive housing, which the ABC Council passed last year. Last year, she split with her ABC caucus and voted to continue building supportive housing, which became one of the main reasons she was actually kicked out of the ABC caucus. So here she was again. You can almost hear ABC saying that, urging council to reconsider building supportive housing. So in the five-minute video on WeChat that we've heard so much about, it's a social media resource for the Chinese community. Councillor Zhao talks about this upcoming motion, and he criticizes the motion and says supportive housing brings drugs and gangs to Vancouver. And then he jumps the shark by alleging that a few non-ABC councillors themselves are drug users, also claiming that they openly distributed drugs before Christmas, all of this in Mandarin. So he urges his supporters in the Chinese Canadian community to speak up before these drug dens are built, and they responded. That anti-supportive housing community has some real organizing power. For example, last week, a BC Housing supportive housing proposal that was planned on Imperial in Burnaby's Royal Oak neighborhood was withdrawn in no small part because of a petition championed by the Chinese anti-supportive housing groups against the project. It collected over 14,000 signatures, and there are several large protests against the project, and the whole thing was withdrawn. So after finding out about Councillor Zhao's WeChat video, Councillor Rebecca Bly Pete Fry from the Greens, Lucy Maloney from One City, and Sean Orr from COPE held a press conference alleging that ABC counselor Lenny Zhao accused them of both using and distributing drugs. And they talked about these statements breaching Vancouver's code of conduct, and they were going to refer matters to the Vancouver Integrity Commissioner, who deals with these kind of code of conduct allegations. But hours after this press conference, Councillor Zhao released a statement saying, and I quote, "My comments were based on incorrect information, and for that, I unequivocally apologize. I'm retracting this statement, and I've taken down the video."
So what happened to that original motion?
Well, Councillor Zhao got the community out because there was apparently Councillor Bly said there's 8 to 9 hours long people who wanted to speak to this pro-supportive housing. And she just said, look, this is ridiculous. I'm going to withdraw the motion. You know, her quote seemed to infer that the issue had become even bigger than supportive housing and now had morphed into the, what she calls, quote, the misinformation and divisive tactics at City Hall. And again, quoting her, trying to have a constructive debate about this was not going to happen.
So that's where it sat until Mayor Sim was heard to say that he supported Councillor Zhao's remarks at the time. And he added a specific accusation about COPE Councillor Sean Orr. So what did he say exactly?
The quote is, "We have a councillor, Sean Orr, just this Christmas, he was handing out illegal drugs on Christmas Day to people on the street. Apparently, somebody showed him a picture, a supporter of Sim's, that turned out to be fake. So despite no verification of the photo's reliability, he just went ahead and accused Councillor Orr of drug distribution. Councillor Orr denied this and added that he's been a target of character assassination throughout his limited time on council. And Mayor Sim did apologize. He apologized, Councillor Orr, saying that's really not enough. He's considering other actions, including a defamation lawsuit. So there it sits as of today. But you know, these shallow apologies and unanswered questions are not going to get Mayor Sim out of this mess yet.
Let's move to the massive new plan for the city that Vancouver Council is considering this coming week. What is being proposed?
Well, it's called the Vancouver Official Development Plan, and it will set out long-term policy for land use and development citywide. It's supposed to last for the next 30 years and beyond. It's going to incorporate all of the Vancouver's existing plans that many listeners have heard about, the Vancouver Plan, the Broadway Plan, Local Area Plan. Anyways, they're going to put them all into one big official plan, which in fact all municipalities in BC must have by the end of June this year. And specifically, it will be directing the location of land uses, such as where's the residential, where's the mixed use, where's the industrial, where's the institutional. So for the residential component, which is the vast amount of this plan in Vancouver, virtually a whole city will be carved up to accommodate high rises, which are up to 26 stories around the transit areas, mid-rises, 7 to 12 stories in what's called neighborhood centers, low-rises, about 3 to 6 stories in 27 village centers that they've identified, and multiplexes everywhere else. The downtown and the West End are already developed, and there's no effect on them, particularly with this plan. It's not just that this plan has to establish some kind of 30-year vision for the transportation network of movement of people and goods in this. They have to identify the type and extent and location of parks and open spaces, natural areas, and how they all ecologically connect. And then planning of the infrastructure and amenities needed to service this growth.
That sounds like it could take 10 of the 30 years to get all that sorted out.
They've been working on this for a couple of years now.
What are people saying about this?
Well, like all plans, opponents say the devil's in the detail. opposition to this is fierce and very political, so much so that it could be one of the defining issues of the October municipal election, especially by Colleen Hardwick and her team for a livable Vancouver. So they say any rezoning from single sites or area-wide that is deemed consistent with this ODP, or official development plan, will no longer require a public hearing. And they believe that's a fundamental breakdown in civic democracy. They go on to say they got other reasons too, that the ODP focuses on large blocky towers everywhere, the scrapping of these community plan in favor of a one-size-fits-all approach citywide. They don't like that at all. Issues with infrastructure planning, unaffordability, renter protection. They've got a list of things. On the other side of this is what's called abundant housing, who thinks even more, not less, should be done. They say that the crisis demands a more effective and urgent response, and they believe that housing in Vancouver will not be available and affordable until apartments have been legalized across the city in every neighborhood, on every street, and the official development plan doesn't do this. So this will begin to play out this Tuesday at 6 p.m., but I'm sure this will go into overtime over the next couple of weeks.
Let's get back to Mayor Sim. In the last month, he's been giving away money that was not mentioned in the budget for his pet projects. $4 million for a police training academy in the Woodwards building, $2 million for a 40-minute fireworks display, and he has another giveaway that he wants council to approve this coming week. What's this one for?
Well, a little background. Unless you've been living in a hole, I suppose, you know all about FIFA and World Cup. It's less than 100 days before it arrives here in Vancouver, and the city's already carrying close to $600 million in costs. Most Vancouverites can't afford a ticket to see a game, so the city has organized a five-week FIFA fan festival at the new P&E Amphitheater. That's going to cost them another $20 million. But still, the city's been criticized for having...
There's a new episode of Red Eye. Hear more of their public affairs and arts programming every Saturday from 10 to noon PST at CFRO 100.5 FM in Vancouver and at HarbingerMediaNetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's community of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. And by The Alberta Advantage. Find the show's almost 9 years of archived episodes at albertaadvantagepod.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Blue Sky and Instagram for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 89 socially and politically progressive podcasts. And if you're in Winnipeg, come join us for Harbinger's fourth Progressive Public Symposium, happening at the University of Winnipeg with Jeremy Appel, Emily Lita, Roberta Lexier, Elle Jones, and others as a kind of off-fringe event a few minutes walk from the NDP Leadership Convention. Find out more about that this week on our Blue Sky and Instagram accounts. We'll be back with a new episode next week. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
The NDP is, 350-plus riding associations. That could be 350-plus community organizing hubs. We've said that a lot of times, but we have to ask ourselves, why is it that the left in this country, by and large, does not really fully engage with electoral power? What is this thing about being nonpartisan that's so specific and almost taken up like as a holy ideological stance that is not strategic?
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. J. Drew Lanham is a poet and ornithologist whose work intertwines his lived experience as a Black man in the American South and his love of wilderness. Both have taught him that joy is a source of strength.
I find my joy on daily walks around the farm or just sitting and watching some bird and it doesn't have to be a rare bird. This past spring, I was just enthralled watching robins. It was like they were so happy that spring was here, they would just sit in little shafts of sunlight. I can see that bird. I can just see it, just sitting there in the middle of dooryard violets. I could see its eye blink, and then it opened that yellow beak and like yawned, and it didn't move. That was just it. It was just being.
It's easy to get so caught up in the hustle and bustle of modern life that we forget how to be present, or even take for granted that we're free to choose joy.
It sounds simple, but you have to grab it, you have to grasp it, you have to keep it. But however you get it, you turn to it as your superpower. And it's what keeps you alive from moment to moment.
Hear more from Drew in season 7 of our podcast, Bring Birds Back. For Bird Note, I'm Chazzy Johnson.